Hello, my name is Ben Jenkins. Welcome back to another episode of the ACN podcast, the official podcast of the Australian College of Nursing. In today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jason Waterson. Jason is a clinical nurse manager for the intensive care and hyperbaric unit at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. Jason has extensive history educating on the topics of intensive care and hyperbaric nursing, and I would like to highlight the latter in this episode. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Nice to be with you, and thanks for the invitation to join you.
Fantastic. So Jason, I'd like to start the episode today by learning more about the unit that you are a clinical nurse manager for at the Alfred. It's a combination of both intensive care and hyperbaric services.
Yeah, that's right. So we are technically the Department of Intensive Care and Hyperbaric Medicine. So our intensive care unit has four specialty pods, if you like, and I like to think of hyperbaric as the fifth specialty pod. So we sit under their umbrella. Within our specialty, though, we cover a whole bunch of areas and patient populations. I'm also the clinical lead for education.
And I understand that you've been doing that for quite a while, and so I can imagine you're well around all both intensive care and hyperbaric services. What got you into the area of hyperbaric?
Look, it was a great opportunity. I've been working here at the Alfred on and off since 1996, and when I first started here as a ward nurse, it was an area that really just got my interest because it was something I'd never heard about during my undergraduate nursing. And so I thought, well, I've got an opportunity to do this in a hospital. There's not many facilities, one generally in every state that people work at. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And here I am sort of 20 odd years later, in and out in multiple different roles now, leading the department, which is really exciting and nice to have been in all the roles from a junior clinician right through to the manager. So, yeah.
Now, Jason, I don't have a lot of experience with hyperbaric nursing, and that's why I'd love to learn more about that from you today and to share that with the listeners. The extent of my knowledge is that the service not only caters for dive-related incidents, such as decompression sickness, but it's also used for the management of chronic wounds. Would you be able to provide a bit of an overview of what the decompression chambers are and what they're used for and how exactly they work?
Yeah, so our chambers and I guess most of the all of the chambers now in Australia and increasingly around the world, we've gone from that traditional cylindrical dive chamber or what was seen on offshore diving or in other areas that have used dive chambers to what are now really clinical facilities, no different to an ICU cubicle. Or a ward cubicle, fully plumbed and, all the gases and electrical outlets that we would require for high acuity patients are there. They're TGA registered devices now in Australia, which means the governance around how they're maintained and what can go in and out of them is really strict. In terms of patient numbers, we here at the Alfred, we see about 300 patients a year, which is not very many patients in terms of what other areas would see. Certainly it's with the bigger units in Australia, hyperbaric units in Australia, they'd see similar numbers to us, but that equates to about 3,500 patient treatments a year. On average, most of our routine, what we call our routine patients, so our chronic wounds, our diabetic wounds, our radiation injury patients would have between sort of 20 and 40 treatments. Some of our wound patients anywhere up to 60 treatments before we discharge them from our service. So as you said, I guess most people would have traditionally seen hyperbaric medicine as the treatment of dive injury, decompression sickness. And that's is where I guess the science started, and that's got a lot of good evidence around it. And I think over the years, we've certainly in Victoria, and Victoria is quite a popular diving location, despite the fact that our weather's not as good as up north. There's actually probably more divers, serious diving happening in Victoria because of the depth of the water, and we've got a lot of shipwrecks. And so we see a lot of technical and deep diving, and that then has its own complications. A lot of other states see a lot of commercial diving, particularly Tasmania with the salmon farms. So they see a lot of decompression sickness. A lot of the other states will be recreational divers, and most people would probably think, you know, Queensland would be the busier states, and they tend to be busy, but they're not. They tend not to see as many divers because most of the diving there is quite shallow, warm water diving, where it's a lot safer. And I guess an interesting fact for the listeners, the term the bends, which is what most people would recognise rather than decompression sickness, comes out of the traditions of where decompression sickness, or what it was originally called in caisson disease, was first described in workers working on bridges and underwater in bridges like in the Brooklyn Bridge in America, where they were working in caissons, pressurised and air coming into those, and they'd come out at the end of a long day's work bent over with lower back and joint pain, and it was described as the bends because they were bent over, and that was the initial description of their symptoms. So just a little interesting fact there. But realistically, as I said, 90%+ of our patients now would be in indications other than decompression sickness. So we generally follow indications as per the Underwater Medical Society in America, and there's about 14 indications. We don't necessarily in Australia treat all of those, and certainly across different states we treat a little bit differently in each state, so not every state will treat the same things. For example, the Alfred is probably one of the only units in Australia that doesn't treat carbon monoxide poisoning, whereas most others do. We treat a lot of radiation injury, both pelvic radiation injury and mandibular radiation injury. Patients who have had cancers of those areas and then had radiotherapy and develop either bladder or bowel bleeding or degeneration of their mandibular bone, which we can treat. And essentially the pathophysiology behind those conditions and wound conditions that we treat is really around angiogenesis, so redeveloping blood vessels within that damaged tissue, hyperoxygenation, and there's a bit of evidence coming through around the effects of pressure and hyperbaric oxygen on reducing edema, and we're seeing that with some of the acute crush injuries as well. And we were the lead site, and one of our consultants was the primary investigator for a large international multi-center study looking at lower limb fracture called the HALT study a few years ago now, which he's just about to publish some results on. And that was really a fantastic study looking at traumatic lower limb fractures and the use of hyperbaric oxygen as well. So it's quite a diverse thing, and the evidence for a lot of those areas is growing. In some areas it's quite small and it's quite low level. But we are, as an international community, we are working very closely in developing the evidence for that, and there's quite strong growth in development of things like registries in hyperbaric medicine now.
Well, it seems the sheer diversity of what hyperbaric nursing can do is amazing. So I can imagine that you'd always be learning.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing that keeps me coming back and keeps me wanting to talk about it, because I think a lot of people would really have no idea about how diverse the nursing input is to hyperbaric.
So keeping on the track of nursing, so for a registered nurse working in this specialty, what would a typical day-to-day look like working on the floor?
Yeah, so I guess from my unit's perspective, we have a range of nurses. Most of the nurses who work in our unit are intensive care trained nurses. We have a couple of emergency trained nurses and a couple of ward general nurses, but primarily we're intensive care linked, and so therefore most of our staff are intensive care nurses, which is beneficial for some of our patient populations. Typically our day, we do routine treatments in the unit, in our multi-place unit, where we have between, in COVID times, we can only have 6 patients. In non-COVID times, when we can fit a few more in, we can fit about 8 or 9 patients in the chamber. And so we would run those 2 treatments, one at 8 o'clock in the morning for us and one at 11 o'clock in the morning. And then the nursing staff also in our unit, we're the only unit in Australia that has trained our nursing staff to operate our monoplace chambers. So our monoplace hyperbaric chambers are basically a big cylinder, which just the patient goes into and has their treatment. And our nurses are trained to operate those. So it means that once they've done a treatment, like a diver, the nurses take on a nitrogen load and they need some time to recover and what we call off-gas that nitrogen. And so they can't go back into the chamber from a safety perspective, we say for 24 hours, just to ensure they don't develop the bends. And so to offset that, they can then work in that monoplace area or outside the multiplace chamber as what we call an outside attendant. So it's quite a diverse range. We also, for as I said, 90%+ of our patients are routine wounds or other patients. And so they'll do a range of things from wound care. And we have a couple of nurses who have postgraduate qualifications in wound management because they essentially are managing, you know, sort of 10, 20 patients on our books at a time who've got various types of wounds. And we also have obviously our ICU patients. We have a large ICU treatment population here. So we're the busiest critical care facility in the country. We treat about 30 ICU patients a year, which is about 102 ventilated treatments a year. So we keep ourselves busy with a really diverse range of patients.
I'd like to learn more about the very acutely unwell patient who is coming in. What does it look like? Obviously, from the pre-hospital's perspective, they take up this patient, they then take to the Alfred emergency department. At what level do they then come into an area like these chambers? What happens if they require something like mechanical ventilation, they need to be sedated? Are these nurses in there monitoring these patients and actively managing that quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said before, most of our nurses on staff in my unit are intensive care trained. We also then have a pool of what we call our on-call nurses, which are our, we run a 24-hour service. So we have our day, Monday to Friday nurses, and then we have our on-call nurses who cover a 24-hour service should we need to treat a patient outside of our normal business hours. Most of our patients would, by virtue of the fact that they are intubated and they're critically unwell, normally on multiple infusions, inotropes and various other things, would come to us and be admitted to our intensive care unit. And then when it's appropriate, they would either come to us and have a treatment, and depending on what they're being treated for, they'd either come to us as a priority or they'd go and have some surgery. So most of our intensive care level patients treated in our unit are coming to us because they have a necrotizing soft tissue infection, or what was, again, a few years ago now, called, often referred to as flesh-eating disease. But necrotizing soft tissue infections, which are essentially an infective process which damages the tissue down to the muscle fascia and through the fascia, and requires obviously surgical intervention to remove the necrotic tissue, antibiotic therapy, and the third arm of that therapy is hyperbaric oxygen. And we're a unit that's very heavily involved in researching that area, and myself and one of our medical staff have been doing some work in some early trial work leading hopefully in the next 12 months, 18 months to the commencement of a randomized controlled trial of necrotizing soft tissue infection, which we hope to collaborate internationally and obviously with our Australian centers who treat that disease. But so those patients, as you said, they would come to ICU, they'd be stabilized and ensure that they've got all the right things in order for them to come into the chamber. And that includes having some temporary holes put in their tympanic membrane so that their tympanic membranes don't rupture while they're being pressurized, and make sure that all of the equipment that goes into the chamber is safe to go into the chamber. We have dedicated ventilators, which over the last 5 years, we've traditionally not had great technical advances in ventilation in hyperbaric medicine. But probably 5 or 6 years ago now, there was an advancement in one of the ventilator companies came out with a new ventilator, which was essentially the same ventilator they were using in ICU, which enabled us to then, they made some modifications to that and made it hyperbaric compatible. And we now run those ventilators as do most of the hyperbaric units in Australia now as they've upgraded. Most of the other things that go into the chamber can be made safe to go into the chamber purely by either removing a battery. Often batteries are the biggest single challenge, and it's looking at closely. Again, we're a very lucky unit here. We're the only unit in Australia and probably the world who employs a biomedical engineer full-time in order for us to look at our equipment safety and follow a very strict engineering process in testing equipment to ensure that what goes into the chamber isn't going to hurt the patient or the chamber or the staff. So essentially, as I said earlier, our chambers are set up and are another extension of our intensive care unit. So whilst we treat mostly routine patients, we can wheel in our patients from ICU on their standard ICU bed, hook them up to our ventilator, and we undertake that almost two-hour treatment with a nurse inside caring for them exactly as they would at the bedside in ICU. So everything continues the same as it would in ICU.
I can imagine the nurses would have to be pre-checked, be able to Valsalva their ears and be able to dive as well. Is there any other sort of considerations?
So anyone working in hyperbaric environment needs to undertake regular medical assessments to ensure that they're fit to pressurize. So it's no different to diving. In that you have to be, but because we're in a workplace, obviously we're governed by work health and safety or health and safety laws. So it's a bit more like commercial diving environments where we have very strict controls around fitness to pressurize and fitness to work in the environment. That's a real challenge for people who love working here, but for whatever reasons, they either become temporarily unfit, and that might be something like even just having a cold, some of our female staff members who become pregnant and can't work in the environment, right through to permanent unfitness. And that might be that they develop a condition that means that it's contraindicated to pressurized work. But so we undergo medicals every 2 years to ensure that we've not developed any lung conditions that would prevent us from going in. We've not developed any other conditions that would prevent us from going in the chamber. And so that's the way that we ensure our staff are safe and our patients are safe.
So Jason, for nurses who are listening to this right now who are interested in entering this specialty, what sort of qualifications do they need, and how would you recommend them going about entering it?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting area. There used to be a postgraduate qualification in hyperbaric nursing, which was run out of Adelaide University. And as you might imagine, it's a pretty small specialty area. And so our university friends don't often like to run niche courses for small numbers because it's not financially viable for them. And so unfortunately that course was no longer offered probably 6 or 7 years ago now. And so most of the units in Australia at the time were running in-house training, and they still do to this day. And that's really... that's really on a standardised format. So all of the units in Australia, from a nurse training perspective, have agreed on the number of hours and the format and the content that's delivered, which effectively mirrors the medical training that's done as well. And I like to think that our nursing courses are at the same standard as the medical courses that are run around Australia. We've been lucky. We've been we're the only unit in Australia who has employed a clinical educator to work in hyperbaric. And so I was fortunate enough to be employed into that position 7 years ago and to set that position up. And what we were able to do as part of that was to partner with Monash University here in Melbourne and develop our nursing course in affiliation with them as a professional development, continuing professional development program. So whilst it's not a degree course, the program itself sits within a professional development framework at Monash University and still has some checks and balances against that. We offer that course to nurses in Hong Kong, in a chamber in Hong Kong. We've offered the course to a couple of nurses from the Royal Thai Navy and the Greek Navy. And we have regular inquiries from various places because we do have that affiliation. So we've sort of pushed the boundaries on nursing education in the environment, and we continue to look at how we can improve and ensure that the level of training that we provide for our nurses and nurses who choose to come and do our course is at the highest standard possible.
Jason Watterson, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the ACN podcast.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ben. It's been great being here.